for this spring, Eliza? Be a Ritz?
All I want is a room somewhere, far away from the cold night air, with one enormous chair out, wouldn't it be lovely? Lots of chocolate for me to
Welcome
eat.
Back to Midday on WNYC. You should see Lauren Ambrose's face right now. She hears her own voice. Lerner and Lowe's 1956 musical My Fair Lady, based on George Bernard Shaw's play Pygmalion, has not generally been seen as a controversial show until now. In the wake of the Me Too movement, the relationship between Eliza Doolittle and Professor Henry Higgins, who makes a bet that he can teach the Cockney Flower Girl to speak like a lady, has come under closer scrutiny. Lauren Ambrose and Harry Haddon Payton star in the show, which is presented by Lincoln Center Theater, and they're both nominated for Tony Awards, and they're both sitting in front of me right now,
Woo!
Still mesmerized by what's going on in our headphones with the music. Welcome to Midday.
Shh, be quiet. Thank I'm
you.
Trying to hear myself.
Yeah, it was you. It wasn't me, was it? I think it was you.
So, well, let's just talk about the Tony right away. Were you? How surprised were you by the nomination? They're still speechless.
I think we knew the nominations were coming up. I was very happy.
Yeah, it was really. I think it's such a nice opportunity to celebrate everybody's hard work and have a moment of knowing that everybody's hard work is being acknowledged.
Almost 200 people in that theater who've collaborated to bring this thing, this monster of a show, to the public, and it's wonderful to be able to celebrate it and share it with them.
And even the personal, you know, nomination for is you know, there's so many people who go into creating this particular Eliza Doolittle from, you know, the costumes and the choreography and Bart and Harry and all the actors.
Well, Harry, this is your New York, your first time on the New York stage, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, and first musical.
And your first musical.
Yeah.
Wow, not bad for a first-time effort.
No,
here,
I know.
Big Apple.
I know. Follow that. Right.
Good luck.
It's I feel very fortunate. It's incredible to have this opportunity with such an iconic role, and the fact that they've trusted me with it is I can't really get my head around. But I'm very grateful they did.
You know, Lauren, I said as you came in here when I saw the performance last Sunday, I kept looking at you thinking, why does she look so familiar? And no, I did not read the playbill. And so it wasn't until I was getting ready. I was like, oh, of course, she was from 6 feet under. That's why I feel like I know you. But did you study to be a singer?
Yeah, I studied singing growing up and started as a singer and thought that was what I was going to do. And then my, you know, career took a different turn and I started... But I've always been looking for something to sing in, so I'm really grateful that I had the opportunity to finally do it.
Yeah, that voice doesn't just happen.
You know, right,
just,
I was going to say.
That requires a bit of work. It's amazing.
Wait, so then, given what you just said, is this the first Broadway musical you've done?
Yes, yeah.
So for both of you, so you're both Broadway newbies, musical newbies.
Clinging to each other.
Yes,
like,
thank God for Harry.
Thank God for Lauren.
I'm so happy to be working with him.
So Lauren was in 6 Feet Under and other shows. And Harry, for those who don't know this, you might know him from the British television series Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
I know you from The Crown.
Martin.
And I've already taught you this is your Broadway debut. This is your first theater debut. Now let's talk about this production. The original production ran for more than 6.5 years, the most successful musical of its time. But this is the first Broadway production in 25 years,
I think, yeah.
Why do you think it's not done more often? Is it the difficulty of the staging, the political issues?
It is difficult
issues?
To stage. It's a big, firstly, it is a
it's
big...
massive.
It's a big thing to stage. There are lots of different locations.
Literal moving pieces.
Exactly. And I think the original production had two...
Turntables.
Wow.
And the interval had to come at a different place to allow for the set to be moved. And so an awful lot has to go into just staging it, firstly. Mm-hmm. How do you get from one location to another?
There's also a 30-piece orchestra and just the most lush orchestrations and music. And, you know, when
you
the center's
do it
doing it right, they've got a 30-piece orchestra that you can even see on stage at a certain point.
And an ensemble of 30.
Yes. I was about to ask, there are a lot of people, more than 37 people?
People in the cast,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a busy building. But I think that's the reason. And the people that hold the rights to My Fair Lady obviously feel passionate. I think, as everyone does, feel you're passionate about the piece and want to do it properly. And you know, I think there were lots of pieces, lots of places vying for the rights to this, and we're very grateful that Lincoln Center Theatre
was chosen,
and that they in turn chose us.
I have to ask you, because speaking of that turntable, how difficult is that to perform where you're walking through doors and the thing is turning and you're singing and you're speaking? And,
I have a bunch of secret costume changes that happen. While the house is turning, I go into a cupboard with my dresser.
And it's like an ambulance.
Yeah, it's like an ambulance. It's an emergency at all times. and it's rocking and rolling, and I'm, you know, switching things. It's insane and running out. At first it was unsettling, but then you kind of get used to it. It's like surfing. It's a core workout.
Yeah, it is.
We use our core.
You can get a bit nauseous, but it's it's fine.
By now you're used to it.
Yeah, I'm getting used to it.
So this production has been called a My Fair Lady for the Me Too movement. Was that intentional?
What? I don't think you can ignore the conversations that are going on outside. And I think that's the beauty of doing a revival, is that you re-look at a piece of work that has stood the test of time, and you put it into the context of whatever's going on right now outside the theater.
Right, we just happen to be doing this play right now in 2018. And interestingly enough, it was chosen long before all of this. I mean, this was in the works, and this was the plan. So it's kind of fascinating that we're rehearsing this play at the time that we're rehearsing it.
Yeah. Well, so talk about rehearsals. What was that like, just rehearsing this play? But then, again, like you said, this was chosen to be done long before Me Too became a thing, but now you're in the middle of it. And for people who know the musical or who are sitting in there and they're hearing some of the lines in this context, it's a little jarring. Or it can be.
Yeah, it's a complicated tale. And, you know, the George Bernard Shaw wrote this piece about Pygmalion, about gender, but also about class and class equality. And some of the songs are interesting to hear in this moment.
I have lines like, "Why can't a woman be more like a man?"
Oh, that song, when you were performing, I was like, oh my God. Like every word.
I know. Well, imagine how I feel saying that. Out of context, it's considerably worse than, I think, during the show. I won't be performing it at the Tonys. But it's... I think in the context of the piece, it's a very forward-thinking play that Bernard Shaw's written. And they both have these journeys, and I think for him to have any sort of redemption at the end, I have to face these terrible lines face on and make the most of them, so that you see him, you know, regret it slightly at the end.
You know,
and it's what I love about doing a revival, or, you know, you take this antique material and you're looking at it now.
Breathe fresh life into it.
Yeah, and you're hashing it out and doing it and having these discussions in the place where we should have them, in the theater. Mm. You know, looking at where we came from, looking at how we got into the pickle we're in. So, you know, looking at what a woman's experience was in 1911.
And how far we've come, or not.
Or not. Norbert Leo Butz, who plays Eliza's father, was here the other day, and he said that you all had long discussions during rehearsals. But what were those like, from your perspective?
Well,
The normal sort of
you sit around the table and you talk about
there were certain
the
moments in the piece. The ending is pretty iconic, and
we're going to get there.
Okay,
I want to talk about that.
But things like that required a lot of discussion and collaboration. I think that's what was great, is that Bartlett Sher, our director, and Andre Bishop from the Lincoln Center Theatre, they've set up this building that is so collaborative, and anybody can have an opinion and chip in, and Bart's open to everybody's ideas. He welcomes the children into the theatre. Yeah. So everybody is, it feels like a real family. And
a really great collaborative place and space.
And our better halves are allowed to have an opinion, and Bart really listens to them.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody is allowed to pitch in. And that's where good creative work comes from, collaboration.
That's interesting. Have your better halves chimed in during these discussions?
Yeah.
Oh, inevitably.
Like outside of rehearsals, yeah. But absolutely. Yeah.
So I should reintroduce the audience to the two fine people sitting in front of me, Lauren Ambrose and Harry Haddon Payton, both starring in My Fair Lady at the Lincoln Center Theater, both Tony-nominated actors, both in their first Broadway musicals. Lauren, I know you've been on Broadway before, but this is your first musical.
True.
So I have to ask you, Lauren, your Eliza seems to be much more in control of her own fate than some of us may remember. And as we've said before, this is set in the early 20th century, 1913. But you've given her, or have you, let me ask the question rather than assert this, have you given her, Eliza, a 21st century sensibility?
It's interesting. People have asked me that. And I don't think I have. I read the book and I hear the music and I'm doing it the way I do it.
Serving the text.
It's people say that it's everything we're doing is in the text. You know, everything we're doing is right there. It was interesting. You introduced us at the beginning and you said it's a play about a show about this man who takes a woman and transforms her or something like
mm-hmm,
it
mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that that's how people think of this show, because when I first looked at it and read it, what immediately struck me was how she hears him talking in Covent Garden about language, and he tosses her a few coins. They have this interaction, and what does she do with that money? She goes to his house the next day. She seeks him out and she says, "I'm here for lessons." She does this act of bravery and this very ambitious move, which is astounding to me. And then that starts off.
Did you say that's a feminist move?
It's
by the way we think about it today.
It certainly has a lot of agency. She absolutely shows up out of her class, out of her realm, out of her depth completely. She doesn't belong in this fancy apartment on Wimpole Street. She shows up and she's ready to better herself. She's got her coins in her purse and she's here for lessons. And
right.
That's very moving to me. And
I think it says a lot about when it was first done, that the imagery we have of it is of Bernard Shaw, Anders Higgins as puppeteers of this
right. young girl.
But what if we? But it's interesting.
But it's
what
not
have
what Bernard
placed?
Shaw had intended. It's not what he wrote.
No.
And that he's so forward thinking.
It's also always pushed to be a romance from the very first productions of Pygmalion. It was always being pushed into the direction of a romance, which, again, was not necessarily the intention of the
piece.
It's
not what the lines say.
It's not what the lines say. It's very clear when you read it. And so it's just interesting what we've placed upon it as a culture.
Yeah.
So, Harry, I have to ask you, you are younger than a lot of the actors who have played Henry Higgins. How do you think that's changed the dynamic between Henry Higgins and Eliza Doolittle?
It was a very deliberate choice, I think, from Bart, but also from Bernard Shaw, who in the stage directions described him as 40-ish, right? So I'm nearly there. But it's, he's not an older statesman in Bernard Shaw's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But Bart, I think, definitely wanted us to enter as equals. And that's what you've got.
Yeah.
You've got two people who are facing eye to eye, head on, and we spend the play sort of going at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately ending as equals as well.
I think there's a journey mm-hmm. that Eliza definitely makes to hold herself as an equal in her own eyes with Henry Higgins. And that's to me... I know you said you'd talk about the end later, but that's to me the goal of the end is that she can hold herself as an equal.
Whose journey is more profound? We go into seeing My Fair Lady thinking that we're going to see Eliza Doolittle make this enormous transformation from Cockney flower girl to princess from Hungary, and yet. It seems as though Henry Higgins is a character who maybe has had more of the interaction has had more of a profound impact on him.
I think probably on both their lives, it's been a big transformation. I think what's interesting about this play is that it's sort of two
different plays.
Mm. You know, in a lesser production, you would see the girl be transformed into a princess, and then that would be it. Mm-hmm. You know, like in Greece, right? She's in her leathers, she's togged up, she's become what he wants her to be.
Right, leather
he's
pants.
Happy. but this, what Bernard Shaw does is takes it in a completely different direction and poses some really interesting questions about where does she fit now?
Right.
How is she going to survive now that he's changed her into something where she doesn't belong? And when she leaves, that puts Henry on a different trajectory as well. So I think they both have big transformations. Yeah. And at the end, it's interesting. Yeah, I don't want to.
Okay, since we let's talk about the ending.
Well, I would just also add, you know, it seems like, yeah, you could say that the transformation is done by the ball, but then in Act Two is when she really, that's when I think I realized, oh, this is when her true transformation begins.
Like she literally, to my mind, she flies away because they're there in Henry Higgins, the study, and they're having that conversation. And just when you think that they're going to live happily ever after, she turns. And
well, we don't want to give away the ending.
Well, I mean, we've already been talking. I mean, yeah. I didn't give it away. This time I did not give it away. Harry gave it away at the very beginning because you said she went away.
Well, no, as in the story, our story, like, leaves us as equals, is what I meant.
We don't necessarily need to give away the ending, but we can say that she... she is now an equal, and there's an also an interesting theme about how a student has to sort of
surpass the teacher,
yeah. Surpass your guru,
find your own
path, and then of course what has Eliza, of course he's given her so much, but what has she taught him?
And Bernard Shaw, like his perfect ending in his eyes was that they would, the three of them with Pickering, would live as bachelors, the three of them, as equals.
Right, because marriage lowers her status.
Yeah. She would be identified through him.
A belonging. I'd be, if I were to marry Henry Higgins, if I were to marry Freddie, that's the pickle of, you know, she gets the mannerisms and the veneer of the fine lady, but now what? Now she's this Frankenstein. She doesn't fit in anywhere. She's sort of a woman without a country. She doesn't have a place to go.
Whether she doesn't have the income that people would need in that society, which they would get from their husband.
And then, you know, and that's sort of the thesis that Alfred Doolittle, the father, played by Norbert Leo Butz, is... is talking about in his scenes. He's talking about how he has so much more freedom, and indeed she, as a young flower girl, had way more freedom in the world than she does by the time she's been transformed into a lady. Mm-hmm. Which is what she wanted, you know.
So I've got to ask you, Lauren, about learning the accents.
Sure.
As an American coming to this role, how did you do it? How did you go about it?
We had an amazing dialect coach, Liz Smith, who's a legend.
Yeah.
And she is very talented, and she worked with all of us, not just me. Even Harry had to learn
I got notes.
You had to improve your English.
Yeah, yeah, I did, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. He's a professor of dialect and phonetics.
Yes.
So he has to be the best speaker in the world if he's teaching someone else.
Right.
Were you horrified by the things you learned that you didn't know?
A little bit.
Such as?
Room.
I say no, but instead of, I always say but or just instead of just or but. Necessary instead of necessary. You know, small things that no one might...
You had to unlearn necessary.
I had to unlearn necessary.
Oh.
And say necessary.
Oh.
If the marbles were necessary for Demosthenes, they're necessary for Eliza Doolittle. Things like that. And that is the detail that Liz would go on.
Yes, she's amazing.
Which is amazing, yeah.
Yeah, very grateful for her work. But it was a lot to get my mouth and my jaw, my American jaw around. It was, you know, definitely a muscular act.
So wait, did Liz Smith put marbles in your mouth to make you make it all happen?
No, Harry does that on stage nightly for me. No, but we did. I did a lot of. I listened to, watched some EastEnders. Listened to Adele talk. And also I had the privilege of having Harry and Alan and Dame Diana Rigg in the room who could, I let them just have free reign of correcting me at all times. I said, when it sounds fakey Fakerson, just kind of hit me in the back of the leg.
You arrived ready as well. Lauren had clearly done a lot of work beforehand. Mm-hmm.
Just listening to EastEnders, really.
Yeah. Really quickly, Harry, I have to ask you this in less than the minute that we have left. Okay. When you were singing, Why Can't a Woman Be Like a Man? I remember it was the Rex Harrison version. It seemed very chauvinistic and angry, but your version seemed rather plaintive to me. Okay. Not as chauvinist. Am I reading too much into this?
I think it's he's questioning it. You know, he's in right. his head. He's trying to work something out. He's not necessarily angry about it.
You're
he's
really
frustrated.
Asking the questions.
He's asking the questions. And why can't a woman be more like me? As in, he's starting the question of what's wrong with me? Why am I not like this? And that's where he ends up.
Do you want to join in?
I can hear some
can you
music
hear it?
Going on in my head.
I've been speaking with Harry Haddon Payton and Lauren Ambrose about their starring roles in the Broadway revival of My Fair Lady at Lincoln Center Theater. Lauren, Harry, thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Hardly happen. How kind of you to let me come.
Now once again, where does it rain?
On the plane, on the plane.
And where's that nasty plane?